Hi, today we're joined by Nick Tyrone, journalist, novelist, and political commentator, who's been described as a waspish writer and natural troublemaker. He sounds like my kind of guy. Nick writes regularly for The Spectator and has contributed to outlets including The Independent, New Statesman, and The Daily Express. He's the author of several books, including the political satire Politics is Murder and the dystopian novel The Patient. With a background running think tanks and working deep inside the Westminster bubble, Nick brings an insider's perspective to British politics. He's currently an associate fellow at Bright Blue. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. The one thing to say is actually I'm not an associate at Bright Blue any longer. Just one of those things that gets trapped in the internet. No, I actually... So I'm the research director at a think tank called the Jobs Foundation, which is run by Matthew Elliott.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Fine. We'll yeah. update our records, and thank you for correcting us on that one.
Not a worry.
Nick, it would be useful for our listeners just to understand a little bit about your political background. You've shared where you are right now. We won't reveal that quite yet. We'll come on to that. But it would be really helpful for us because we're interviewing people from all sorts of political backgrounds, not necessarily reform supporters. They might be, but they might not be. And it would be really great to just to get an understanding of your own journey.
Sure. Yeah, you know, I'd love to. So I was a member, the only political party I've ever been a member of is the Liberal Democrat, member of Liberal Democrats from about 2007-8 to 2016. I just let my membership lapse at that point because I kind of didn't really get where the party was going. I was very much of the sort of Orange Book wing of it, which was sort of, I guess, the right of the party, if you like. It was very much around free markets, free trade, that sort of end of things. And I sort of felt like it was just going in a leftward direction that I didn't really understand. And the amazing thing when I look back on 2016 and having let my membership lapse is that I thought that, my perception of Lib Dems being too Lib Dem, being too left wing in 2016 and how much further to the left they've gone in the succeeding decade. So, things that I did. It's worth revealing that I was actually the chief executive at Center Forum, which is memorable for a couple of reasons. One was it was a think tank that produced the Orange Book, but also that I essentially worked for Paul Marshall for a year and whatever when we were essentially both Lib Dems. Then obviously Paul's gone on a journey since then. I worked on something called the Red Tape Initiative with Oliver Letwin. So that was actually pretty close after Brexit, the Brexit vote, not Brexit itself, but when after the 2016 referendum. So that was really around looking at European legislation and how it had related to UK law and what was there. And we held roundtables with industry and stuff like that. And so I did that for a couple of years. And then I really shopped around a lot of the think tanks. I actually think one of the things that is I don't want to say it's unique in my experience because that's probably a bit facetious, but probably rare is I've worked for a lot of center left and center right think tanks. So, for instance, on the center right, I've worked for Onward. I've done those are my more extensive ones. Obviously, working with Matthew at the Jobs Foundation. I mean, it's cross party, but you know, I'm working with Matthew. And then on the center left, you know, a whole range of them. So there's that. And then I think actually one of the things that I think about my politics over the last couple of years that's been big is one of the things I've been doing with the Jobs Foundation is traveling around the country. And I've particularly been to some of the poorest parts of the country. So I've been to Teesside quite a bit, Middlesbrough, Hartlepool, Redcar. I've been to Rotherham few times, Rochdale, spent some time in South Wales, the Valleys, Swansea, and I think it's actually had quite a profound influence on my politics because I think it's this kind of idea, you know, I live in London, you can be in a bit of a bubble. Obviously, I was in the Lib Dems. I'm around a lot of very liberally London types. And it's interesting when you've been somewhere like Hartlepool for a week, and you spent a week in Hartlepool, and you go back to London, and then you have conversations with your sort of London liberal friends, and it's like you sort of get this, you really start to understand that they are living in their a parallel world to a lot of people in Britain. And you know, things like I stayed in migrant hotels, as in I booked myself into a hotel and then found out once I was there that it was a migrant hotel. And then, you know, you'll be there and it's all these young guys, usually 18 to sort of early 20s. And then, you know, you're back in London and you're watching Question Time and you've got a Labour minister talking about how it's all women and children in these hotels. And you kind of go, oh, okay. I mean, this is interesting.
Well, you what you're seeing is some of the lived reality, isn't it? You've seen across the UK by traveling, by getting out of London, not just Westminster, but some of the other suburbs as well, seeing how other people live. And I live on the border of North Staffordshire and South Cheshire. Cheshire, very affluent county, lots of very, very high net worth individuals. You know, there's lots of farming, very rural. But North Staffordshire, Stoke-on-Trent is the big city down the road. Lots of poverty, lots of deprivation, very much a working class environment. Actually, there's a pride there. There's a cultural pride amongst the people there who've worked in the pot banks and the pottery industry for, you know, hundreds of years, a few hundred years. And I think that's true across some of these other communities, which have been mining communities or you know, communities that have worked incredibly hard, but now just have seen utter degradation. And sometimes I think those communities do feel that Westminster just doesn't understand them.
Well, I mean, I think another thing I've had an experience of that sort of joined up quite nicely with my Jarvis Foundation experience was actually covering some reform stuff for The Spectator. So I covered the local launch, the launch of the local campaign in the one in Birmingham in March of this year. I did some stuff on the road. I went to Runcorn. I saw some of the by-election stuff, and then I spoke to a lot of local reform people, a lot of activists, that sort of thing. And that was really fascinating to me. I think the thing I really found about reform activists is, you know, an interesting a couple of things. One is like sort of how normal they are. I guess that's a strange way to put it, but like just a lot of political activists, you know, are can be a bit odd. You have someone who's been, you know, I don't know, a Tory activist or a Labour activist or Lib Dem activist for 30 years. There's an eccentricity, shall we say. And I was surprised about how many people were just, I'm a guy, you know, I'm a plumber or whatever, and I really haven't been involved in politics at all. And I just saw what was going on in the country, and I felt like I had to get involved. And I heard a lot of those kind of stories. And then it's again coming back to the London liberal bubble of you know, oh, these are all racists and these are all people who, you know, whatever. I mean, not that I thought that about reform activists anyway, but it really that contrast, you know, when you spent the previous night in Nuneaton or Spalding having a pint with some reform activists, and they're all actually lovely people. And maybe you agree with them on some things, maybe you disagree with them on some things, but actually they're just very normal, lovely people. And then you're back to London, and it's, oh, all these people are all fascists or whatever, and how ridiculous that, you know, even more ridiculous that seems, as it were.
Interesting. And of course, you came to the Reform Party conference as well, so you had an
I
opportunity
did.
to meet even more reformers. What were your reflections on the conference, Nick?
Again, sort of coming back to that idea of, I mean, so I just for background, obviously with a think tank background, all that sort of thing, you know, I've probably been to somewhere in the region of about 50 party conferences of different stripes. You know, there were years in my life where I had to do Lib Dem, Labour, and Conservative Party conferences all on the trot. I mean, sometimes more than that. It's like there were years where I did Green conference or even UKIP conference or one of the trade conferences. So a lot of experience with party conferences. And one of the interesting things about this year's Reform conference was, I think, how working class it felt was a big thing. All the other conferences tend to feel very, yeah, very middle class. I don't know how else to put it. You know, it's a lot of professionals. You've got the lobbyists, you've got the journalists. I mean, in the, even the activists can tend to be, they're a little bit in professional activist mode wherever they come from. And there's just an inevitable middle classness about it. And it was just really interesting to have a, something that felt quite genuinely working class. So that was one observation. I think another one was the energy there was really interesting because I mean most of British politics now, if you you know you go to Labour conference, everybody's depressed and it's all a downer and oh God, you know what are we doing in government? This is awful. You got the Conservative Party where they were a little bit in denial for a while, but I think it's starting to set in that like things aren't going particularly well. I mean, Lib Dem conference is always a bit different because they always feel like things are going well. It's a little bit of a weird Lib Dem delusion. But it was interesting to be at a conference at Reform where everybody felt very up. And with good reason. It was, you know, you understood it. I think as well, it's just like really a chance to speak to some very interesting people. I spoke to a chap who was one of the local organizers in Tower Hamlets. And he was an Asian guy, and he was telling me about how like the dynamic in Tower Hamlets and how they felt, how Reform was feeling very bullish in Tower Hamlets, which obviously wasn't somewhere I would have expected necessarily. But you know, he was telling me about how, well, there's a lot of British Asians, a lot of British Muslims even, who are very, you know, their parents came over, they worked hard, there was a lot of, you know, they played by the rules and they assimilated, and this sort of this the antipathy between them and, you know, a lot of people come, you know, illegal migrants, don't want to fit in, hate the country, et cetera. Which as soon as he explained it, I thought, well, actually, that actually makes a huge amount of sense. So I think there's a lot of, it gave me a real overview of a lot of the dynamics that are across Reform. And I think one of the things about the Reform Party is it's genuinely, I'm not just saying this to butter you guys up because I'm on your show, but it is to me the most interesting story in British politics now. It's the most easily the most interesting party in terms of what's happening and where that's going to go, particularly over the rest of this parliament. I think it's going to be the most interesting story in British politics.
Just a few questions on that arose from what you were saying. With these blue book Liberal Democrats, when you see who the Liberal Democrats are competing against politically, which is broadly speaking the Conservatives, and actually it's a lot more so now than it was even 20 years ago, where the Liberal Democrats competed much more broadly across the country, but now they're down to a maximum 90 constituencies where they're competitive, and everywhere else they're nowhere. Whereas 20 years ago there might have been 200 constituencies they were competitive, but they actually only won 30 of them. But now they're concentrating on those 90, they win 70 of them, but they can't go anywhere beyond those 90, roughly
I
speaking.
think yeah, I agree.
And yet they've been going, as you said, in a very leftward direction. But those 90 seats are, broadly speaking, conservative seats. So if you take those two things, one, that there's a lot more competition for that loony left vote from both the Greens and your party, and the Liberal Democrats are actually fighting for votes in the seats where there isn't the natural constituency for that sort of loopy politics, in my opinion. How do you think? But nevertheless, there's a sort of difference between the interests of the party, as you might see if you were taking a sort of dispassionate view of it, and the interests of their activists who do want to be a loony left party. How do you see that's going to work out for the Lib Dems?
Well, okay, so first off, Nick, you've completely nailed it with the Lib Dems. That's exactly what's happening with them. They have this complete disconnect, essentially, from their voters, who tend to be upper middle class in very leafy, suburby type places or Surrey. I mean, they're basically ex-Tory seats, as you rightly pointed out, and very much actually, lots of cases, ex-Tory voters. And essentially, they're like Tory Remainers. That's really what they are. I think they have a kind of ignorance most of the time about what the Lib Dems actually are or what they stand for. I mean, the classic one is actually like with, you know, I live in a nice part of London. You know, people know me as the politics guy and I, you know, write about politics. So they ask me about politics and then we chat about it. And I mean, it's really interesting. One guy said to me, one of the dads or the local dads was like, oh, well, the Lib Dems, the thing that's great about the Lib Dems is they're just so in the center on everything. You know, they're on the center of everything. Like, you know, they're in the center on trans rights. That, you know, they have a perfectly balanced position. You're like, the Lib Dems have a completely loony left. I mean, they're so far left on that trans stuff. It's insane. I mean, they might be the most left-wing party on that stuff, genuinely speaking. I mean, probably with Zach Goldsmith coming to the Greens, that's they probably give them a run for their money. But I mean, for a very long time, I think the Lib Dems were far, on loads of stuff, they were the most left-wing party. And so I think they rely to a large extent on the ignorance of their voters, essentially just going, well, I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to vote for Labour because I don't like them. I mean, no, I don't like the Tories and I'm annoyed at them for lots of reasons. They are not natural reform voters. And so they're sort of parking their vote with the Lib Dems. I guess the question is, can they keep doing this? And I keep thinking, no, they can't because, you know, time will catch up with them. Reality will catch up with them. But then I sort of wonder if that's the case, because if the Conservative Party is going to continue to fade, which I think they will, that's my general sense of things. I don't really see them recovering anytime particularly soon, particularly under Kemi Badenoch. You know, where are those voters going to go? I mean, they're certainly not going to vote Labour. They're not going to vote. I mean, it's almost like, I mean, in a weird sort of way, I almost think they might actually, some of them might actually vote Reform before they'd vote anyone else, but probably not in any great enough number to sort of any of those seats. So what you're going to end up with is the Lib Dems holding on to that seat, but mostly by default. That's what I think. Just mostly because of the craziness of, you know, the current the current wave that we're swept up in of change. I think the Lib Dems probably hold on to a lot of those seats. Just, I mean, just by pure default.
Do you think? I mean, and this was really what I was sort of edging at before, that the logic of their position, of where they have put themselves politically, doesn't lend themselves to those seats. And that actually what that gives is a window of opportunity for the Conservative Party that I do not think is going to outcompete Farage on Farage's territory. But agreed. Nevertheless, could compete for the former Conservative voters who've gone to the Liberal Democrats, the Conservative yep. Remainers, you might say. And yep. If a different leader of the Conservatives was to focus mm-hmm. not on fighting the battle that they're going to lose, but fighting yeah. a battle that they could win, that actually yeah. you might see, because the Liberal Democrats won't go for the Blue Book approach, which would probably lock mm-hmm. those seats up for them, that mm-hmm. the Conservatives could fight back and actually you'd have a sort of merge of, I mean, I don't know which the name of the party would be, but a merger essentially, philosophically, of Blue mm-hmm. Book Liberals and Remainer Conservatives locking up those yeah. constituencies as a niche in the country.
I genuinely think if the Conservative Party pivoted away from what they're doing, which is basically just being a very disappointing, very poor and actually ill thought out version of Reform, that won't work. And I don't think that will ever work. And they became a sort of John Major, Heseltine, sort of that kind of thing, right? Just, you know, very pro, I don't know, Western Alliance, very pro market, really trying to pivot back to business, trying to get the Remainers, basically. I think they could actually completely wipe out the Lib Dems very quickly. I don't actually think it would be that much of an effort for them, particularly, because the Lib Dems are just sort of there by default. So actually, I think you're absolutely right. The Tories could completely take back all those seats. And if I was a strategist for them, I would say, I think you're better off doing that, because at least if you can get all those seats back, you can probably hang on, right? Because that's what the Lib Dems have, 72 seats. I mean, if the Tories manage to hang on to anything like that, I think at the next election, just anything north of 50, then they hang on as a political force, right? That who knows yeah. can ride, you know, one day in the sunset. I think as they're going now, I mean, they genuinely could be completely and utterly wiped out. I mean, to the point where they have like 10 seats. I don't think that's in any way unrealistic. I genuinely don't, because I just think they're not going to make any headway in any of those places. They're going to get completely wiped out. That somewhere like, you know, a lot of the northern seats are just going to go to Reform and the Midlands as well. And where are they gaining seats? Where are they hanging? I mean, I just feel like, yeah, the Tories are on a hiding nothing now. And you're absolutely right. I think if they pivoted more towards a sort of, I don't know, you know, however we want to describe it, a one nation-y kind of very wet Tory thing. They'd get all those, those middle class, people who voted Lib Dem last time. Yeah, definitely.
Particularly because, and this is my last question on the Liberal Democrats, previously within those 90 or so seats that they're competitive, of which they took 70 or so, they were only up against the Conservatives, and they were the recipient of the none of the above vote. But next time round, the Greens almost definitely, and in a few of the seats, even your party, will be competing on the same turf, and the more sort of hairy Liberal Democrats might go for them. And once your vote gets split a little bit, then that does make it much more competitive for the Conservative comeback if they take that approach.
Totally agree. Completely and utterly agree. 100%. I think that, as you say, should kind of be, I think it, the Tories should be thinking about this a lot more, because you're absolutely right in the sense that if the Greens keep growing, and anything could go wrong there, and the left always have a way of destroying themselves, all those caveats in there. But, you know, Zach Polanski, I mean, to all of us on this call, his politics are just utterly bonkers and weird, and we don't, what the hell. But obviously he's reaching some sort of audience that feels alienated by Labour. And, you know, and I actually thought for a long time that someone like Polanski could come along, someone youngish who says all the right things, you know, ticks every box and is, you know, at least reasonably articulate and charismatic enough to just say, do all that in a kind of reasonably presentable way, that you would end up, Labour would have a real problem, because Labour actually could end up in a situation where, a bit like the Tories, actually, they're just completely squeezed, right? They're not actually left wing enough for the young, for the real lefties. They've got the Greens. They're thinking, well, we're going to go that way. And they're sort of trying to cling on to this idea of having sort of even center-right voters who maybe voted for them last time, who, I mean, why would they do that, actually? And I think actually one of the things that could happen, I mean, this is a bit of a stretch, but hear me out. I think one of the things that could happen for reform is, I was talking about this the other day. So imagine this, right? Starmer's, I think, in a lot of trouble. And I think the budget's going to be very bad for him, and the May elections are going to be very bad for him. And at some point, you know, they're going to think about getting rid of him. Now, if they get rid of him, you think about what happened to Angela Rayner. Now, I don't say that completely takes her out of the mix, but it to some extent really hurts her possibility of becoming leader of the Labour Party. And if you look at the current PLP, the Parliamentary Labour Party, who's the most likely leader? And you'd have to say it's probably Ed Miliband, in terms of experience, in terms of, you know, positioning with the membership. So just you've got an Ed Miliband as Prime Minister, who would, I just want to be clear, would be a complete disaster. I mean, if you think Starmer's bad, Ed Miliband would be like a whole other level of unbelievable badness, right? And Nigel Farage will be able to say, look, at the end of the day, it's going to be some sort of Ed Miliband, Zach Polanski government running the country, which will be horrible to a lot of people, or it's me. And actually, I think a lot of people whose politics are nowhere near, like just not really in a Nigel Farage sort of space, will kind of go, that's what I've got to do. Like I almost feel like I don't have any choice. There could, I know everybody's talking about tactical voting against reform, but I think there's a certain situation that's not unrealistic where you actually start to get tactical voting for reform.
Yeah, I think that's very, very likely. And I think the next 6 to 8 months are going to be absolutely critical to decide how that's going to pan out. And I think you're absolutely right, Nick, that we have a very fractious and disrupted political party system now because of what's happened since Labour got in on a wafer thin majority and yet a landslide. And I think that kind of contrast in people's minds feels very weird, that they had a low share of the vote because, of course, the turnout was low, and yet they won a landslide victory. And it doesn't make sense in people's minds. And of course, the policies that they've enacted, have just made things much worse. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about something we referred to earlier, rather secretively, about where you are right now. Because before we started recording, you shared your location. And this is a very good bridge, of course, from talking about Ed Miliband, the Minister for Net Zero, and utter destruction of the UK is how I bracket his title. Tell us about where you are and what you've been exploring and discovering in that location, Nick.
Yeah, certainly. So I am in Aberdeen, Scotland, looking at the energy sector in Aberdeen. I mean, as some people may or may not know, Aberdeen's big industry is energy, oil and gas, traditionally. And it has obviously been walloped by several things, one of which is the energy profits levy, which was brought in by the Tories. And actually, when they brought it in, there are pluses. You could argue either way, whether it should have been, shouldn't have been, in the sense that oil and gas profits were very high at the time for a variety of reasons, partly the Russia-Ukraine war. And so the idea was a windfall tax, right? The problem is what's happened is they've kept it, the Tories kept it in place. Bobby almost undeniably passed the point where they should have, where there weren't really any windfall profits per se to put that on. But then Labour have come in and they've done several things. So one of the things they've done is they put the rate up, way up, by the way, by quite a bit. And they have taken away a lot of the, at least when the Tories brought it in, there were several things like you could get a discount for doing this or you could get a discount for doing that and sort of incentivize certain behaviors. That's all. It's not all gone, but a lot of them are gone. And they've extended it until 2030. Or is it, no, they've extended it to 2028 with a hint that they'll do it till 2030. So you've got that, which is just massive, de-incentivizes any investment in UK energy from abroad. But then obviously the other thing that Ed Miliband has done is stop any, you can't get a license now to explore for oil. And just to give you some idea, Norway just this past summer found one of the biggest deposits of oil that they had ever discovered in the North Sea. And it wasn't even that far from the demarcation line between Scottish and Norwegian water. So there's clearly oil out there. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, even taking the most green line that you possibly can, we're going to need oil and gas for the foreseeable future. We just are. I mean, this is beyond ideology. That's just a fact. And the idea that we're going to wind down British oil and gas industry, which will cost, I mean, a lot of jobs. We're talking like 200,000 odd jobs across the country. I mean, heavily located in places like Aberdeen, but you can go throughout a lot of the country. I mean, it's a huge industry in the UK. And we're going to basically wind it down on the sort of magical thinking that the renewable energy is just going to take over, which is just totally mad. I mean, you have to understand there's no plan for this. This is the thing. When I started doing this, I wanted to sort of understand the plan to transition from oil and gas to renewables in the UK. And essentially, there is no plan. It's just a sort of magical, like, ta-da, this will happen and it will all...
It's purely ideology. It's purely ideology driven by a desire to control. And I personally think it's driven by an incredibly Marxist agenda underpinned by big multinational organizations like the WEF that want to make sure that the ordinary resident, the ordinary parishioner, the ordinary voter, basically has to be completely dependent on the government. And because obviously when you're suddenly dependent, or you're gradually actually dependent on big energy systems that have to be fueled by taxpayers' money and rely on subsidies to even work for those organizations, those independent businesses to be able to survive, they have to rely on government subsidy. Let's not beat around the bush around around this one, that they're not sustainable industries. And even when you look at the way that the electricity is generated, even on the windiest day, many of those windmills have to be turned off because they're creating too much power that we're not able to distribute because our electricity grid is not able to handle the machinations of taking it from DC to AC and correctly distributing it round the grid. And of course, it's those power outages that can happen that we saw in Iberia in the summer when suddenly the grid just goes down. So there are massive, massive issues about renewables that, again, nobody is talking about. Nobody is really discussing. There's a few people, actually. I wouldn't say there's nobody. In fact, we've got somebody coming on the podcast in a couple of weeks' time who's an expert, and she's going to illuminate just how bad the situation is. But equally, of course, we haven't even got a nuclear plan. As you say, there is no plan, Nick.
There's no plan, no. I mean, I think the biggest thing is actually, to some extent, I mean, yes, it's ideological, but actually, in a way, there's a certain level of stupidity here that what's going on in the UK that actually slightly goes beyond the ideological. Let's take Norway, right? Not a very right-wing country. I think we can all agree. It's not. I don't think anybody's describing Norway as a like libertarian paradise. They're doing this way better, and they have actually, even for Norway, quite a center-left government. And what that center-left government is doing is really encouraging oil and gas because they recognize several things, which is creates jobs. Creates energy security, right? It allows us all sorts of ways to do this. Also, it's quite a green government. So they're thinking, okay, well, actually what we can do is we can take the profits of the oil and gas and try and build some sort of renewable energy. And this is what I want to stress about what's happening in the UK. It's just, it goes beyond any of that. What's happening doesn't make any sense at all. You're basically, and essentially in Norway, you've got a thriving oil and gas sector, and actually you have, for what's happening now, at least, you know, in terms of how good these things can be, it's actually got quite a decent emerging renewable sector. We don't have either of those. Basically, we're winding down the oil and gas sector, right? And we don't really have a renewable sector. So we're basically killing one industry to try and build up another that, in the greatest sense, in terms of genuine jobs and GDP and all the rest of it, certainly doesn't exist, at least yet. I mean, if I'm being, you know, being politically centrist here, it doesn't exist yet. So, and the amazing thing is everybody's in agreement with this. So the renewable companies are in agreement with this up here, the trade unions, everybody. So it actually goes beyond left, right, access, whatever. It's what Ed Miliband's doing. I mean, to be fair, he's there's some sort of continuation with the last Tory government, but just the way government strategy is going on this is just it boggles the imagination. It really does. I mean, even beyond ideological kind of ideas, I'm still quite taken with what's happening.
In terms of the cognitive dissonance on this, you've mentioned the Conservatives are implicated, as they are, alongside Miliband. Perhaps you just give us your view. You've just talked about Norway, on the Scottish National Party, which seems to be at least as delusional as Mr. Miliband. Well, not only on energy, but also on trans rights as well. But anyway, just say a word or two about the SNP and their position.
Sure. I mean, the interesting thing about the SNP in this is they are in their favored position, which is essentially they can blame everyone else. And in fact, in this case, they sort of can to some extent, because essentially very little of energy policy is devolved. And the way they will get involved,
the SNP, they don't stick back against some.
No, I agree. I agree with that. But what they'll do, right, is they will they'll spend a reasonably small amount of money opening a kind of energy trend, you know, some sort of green something or other. And then they will go, well, we're trying our best. So what can we do? We you know, if we were running the energy policy within Scotland, everything would obviously be brilliant, which in my opinion, it wouldn't. But let's just leave that to one side. They can kind of say, well, this is all Westminster's fault. And it's one of those cases where, to some extent, they can get away with that, is what I would say.
They could do that, but the thing that I find peculiar is I don't get the impression they are doing that. Although they've got a get out of jail card to be able to argue it like that, they nevertheless have consistently over the last 5 years been actually pushing the green agenda as far and as hard as they can, and haven't been a voice.
But what I'd say is that you're right, but to some extent that is classic SNP stuff, which is basically they can push that stuff and they can push it in an ideological sense, but ultimately they can always say, well, we're not actually responsible for this. So it's not our, whatever happens, it's not our fault. That's really it. So they can kind of play the good guy role of, hey, and they can push it really far. But in a sense, what they can then do is just take a back seat and say, well, it's not us. It's Ed Miliband or it's whoever. You know, if we had run this, it all would have been great. And so yeah, they basically, it's a classic SNP. They kind of, you know, have the cake and eat it too, basically. That's what I think.
Slopey shoulder syndrome.
They're not actually using that excuse, though, are they?
I think they will. I think they will, because I think for the time being, you have quite a left-wing policy in terms of what Miliband's driving, right? So for the time being, they can kind of sit back. But then when it all blows up and it's all a disaster, that's when they'll use that. That's my prediction.
You describe it as left-wing, but I mean, I think really this isn't an ideology. It's more of a religion. And
yeah,
the adherents of this religion cover, in traditional left-right terms, quite a broad spectrum. And there were certainly, for a long time, true believers in the Conservative Party who were pushing. I mean, Mrs. May, for a start, who kicked us off down this line. So I think it can be misleading describing it as left-right.
You're probably right. No. Yeah.
The other thing, if we've done it on energy policy, is how you think that will all bear on the Scottish parliamentary elections with their split regionalist constituency electoral system come May next year before we turn to Wales.
No, absolutely. So I would say that it depends on a lot of factors. I'm really fascinated by how Reform might do. I mean, if I was advising Reform, I would say I would go really heavy on energy, but I would probably go light on the ideology around that. That's just my suggestion. What I would say is, instead of really going net zero, I understand that. What I would say is really focus on the jobs, really focus on, you know, really go, the SNP are just playing handmaiden to what Miliband's doing. There's going to be thousands of job losses here. You're all going to lose. You know, this is going to devastate whole communities. I think actually that would be a really powerful Reform argument. But anyway, that's just my opinion.
I think the other element of that, Nick, of course, is the economic argument. You can make a case very strongly for the economics of it, regardless of the ideology. That you know, going back to Norway again, they're a net exporter. Their GDP is their debt to GDP is much lower than ours is. So in terms of their economic strengths, whatever their political leaning, the economy is in a much better shape. So therefore, if they do decide they want to invest in some of these other more renewable technologies that perhaps Reform wouldn't support, to a certain degree, that's irrelevant because they've got the money to do it. One of the problems is we are broke as a country. We are bust. And because of that, we have to look quite strongly. We have to make that economic argument. And I think, to me, that's where the strength of Reform comes in, because we've got so many people who are very economically educated and understand exactly where we're up to and have got a very strong reasoning and understanding of what needs to be done to bring the UK back from the brink economically. And energy has to be part of that.
Well, energy has to be part of it, no question whatsoever, yeah.
What's your bet?
Yeah.
I mean, it's some way out, but on the outcome of the Scottish Parliament election, do you think, like I do, that Reform are nailed on to be the official opposition?
That's a great question. Nailed on, I don't know. There are several variables. I'd say Reform have a very, very good shot at it, is what I would say. Anything can go. But I mean, if I was going to bet on an outcome, that's the outcome that I would bet on. Yes.
I mean, because the only way that won't happen is if Labour has a miraculous recovery. And again,
correct.
I'll just put a hypothesis to you. Labour obviously got wiped out in Scotland. They made a temporary recovery that was a bit of an aberration in the general election last year for various reasons. So could you just turn your mind to that difference between the entirely first-past-the-post system for the Westminster election and the proportional approach to the Scottish Parliament election with the split list system?
Yeah, sure. So it's a mixed member system, which basically means it's kind of like first past the post with a top up. So you have constituencies, and then what you try and do is you try and even out proportionality by having a list. That's basically it. So you basically have a group of constituency MPs, and you've got a group of list MPs. You know what I mean? Representatives. So that's the Scottish system. What will be interesting is actually whether that is that better for reform or worse, and I'm not really sure. I go both ways. I often go back and forth on this.
I think in the case of Scotland, just because of the multi-party split, because you've got in places you've got you can even have five-way marginals in Scotland.
Although
the Conservatives might drop to the bottom in a lot of those, but five-way marginals, unless something fundamental happens, the SNP will win the bulk of the constituencies.
Absolutely.
That means that in Westminster they have the bulk of the MPs, but for the Scottish Parliament it means they fall well short, because they'll end up with, let's say they got 30%, they're going to end up with about 35% of the MSPs.
Yeah.
But they'll overperform, but they won't overperform by the same proportion that they would do in the Westminster election.
Correct. Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah. I get what you're driving at. Basically, what you're saying is, okay, the SNP take most of the constituencies, which is essentially first past the post, but then when the proportional bit kicks in, actually reform should be able to do pretty well. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes, but also in Scotland, I stand to be corrected, but I think you actually put two different votes on the ballot paper.
That's
one
correct.
One for the constituency and one for the regional list.
That's right.
And people do split their vote so that they go SNP first. And so the question is, if you're voting SNP, because we do know that reform is taking votes off the SNP, but perhaps they might but obviously other SNP voters might be more interested in splitting. They might just go SNP, but then the second one's pretty much a waste. But if they go SNP Green, well, then there was the unfortunate circumstances of the Green coalition. So would they do that again? I don't know. Yep. Or do they go nationalist for the constituency and unionist for the list?
Could be. I mean, one of the things that I agree. I mean, I think that's going to be fascinating. I think that's why Scotland's so difficult to call, because the rise of the Greens nationally, how does that play out? The collapse of Labour, the collapse of the Tories. That's the thing that's what makes it so difficult to call these things, is because it's sort of unprecedented that you'd have such a particularly so dramatic a collapse of both the Labour and the Tory vote at the same time, and essentially a whole other mix of parties coming in and taking up that vote. I mean, you know, Keir Filley was fascinating just in the sense of, like, it was actually really pretty hard to call, because you basically had Plaid and Reform, two parties that had never really done particular, I mean, nowhere close to that, because I mean, it was basically a safe Labour seat before. And so when the Labour vote collapsed, what
happened? Plaid was on sort of 20-odd% previously. So,
they had a presence. A presence. But
I mean, if you compare the poll that put Reform as winning, Reform wasn't actually far off that on the election.
No.
The thing that changed was the Labour vote dropped, and presumably tactical voting from Labour went to Plaid to give them that 40+% victory. My back of the envelope calculation was that at 11% Labour, if you do that sort of de Hont redistribution probably wouldn't have made enough, because Reform was sufficiently far in front of Labour to have delivered three seats. If it was replicated across the broader constituency on the same distribution of votes, that you'd have had a 3-3 split between Plaid and Reform.
You almost certainly would have. It would have been. It would have been bizarre if not. That should that essentially in the new system, which is basically 16 constituencies, but it's all proportional, and there's six representatives for each of them, so you have 96. If that exact had the exact result had been had happened, I mean, particularly given the, what Labour were second or sorry third on 11, weren't they? So it unquestionably would have gone 3-3. Yeah, and so
It's where you need to be a nerd, because whether 11s or is enough depends on the precise vote of the second place party. And,
Wendy's
told me I can't disappear down that rabbit hole any further because it'll bore the people who are.
Well, I'm conscious that Nick's given us very generously of his time this evening, and we could definitely go down that rabbit hole. Let me tell you, Nick Tyrone, I've gone down that rabbit hole with Nick Goulding. And interesting though it is, I think it might be the topic for another podcast.
Would you be interested in, because I know, like me, you were on that AV campaign when we had the referendum on that. And I know you're interested in that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Would you be interested in doing a couple of specific ones focusing on A, Wales, and B, Scotland, looking at the impact of the electoral system?
Yeah, no, I definitely would. I'd be very happy to do that.
We could do a little bit more background research first, a little bit more homework, and then could talk more authoritatively on how that might impact on the way things diff out on next May.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because the reality is, although as Wendy rightly says, most people aren't interested.
Yeah.
It's rather like with Care Philly, the fact we didn't win, although I think the general reporting has been fairly said, okay, Reform's a little bit disappointed, but they did very well, is roughly speaking. But rather like winning in Runcorn by six votes, if you do get the seats, it makes a big difference to how people perceive it.
It does.
And so these two proportional systems will be very influential in the narrative as we go forward from next May as to how people see things positioning. And so they're important, obviously, for their own election, but they're also important for how politics proceeds from that point.
Agree, totally. Yeah.
So if we park that one and we can make another date and if it's so boring that no one else is likely to want to listen to it, well, we can have a good conversation ourselves.
Exactly. I'm up for that. No worries. Yeah.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Yeah. Great. Great to meet you, Nick. Thank you for coming on. We'll let you know when the podcast is released.
Okay. Sounds great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks very much indeed.
Excellent. Bye-bye. Cheers.
Bye. Bye-bye. Have a good night.